From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Gaddafi, the U.S., and the Muslim world. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A weekend assault by Muammar Gaddafi's forces appears to have divided Libya in half, with a stalemate that could mean prolonged civil war. Nobody seems to know just who the rebels are, where they get their weapons, or what they want beyond Gaddafi's ouster. The U.S. is in a tricky position, talking tough and creating international expectations, but lacking a strategy or the support required for intervention. Is a real humanitarian crisis unfolding? Does Gaddafi have what he needs to hold on? Should the U.S. commit military forces in yet another Muslim country? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a hearing on Muslim Americans and terrorism, defense requirement or hypocrisy. First the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with To the Point. Muammar Gaddafi appears to have staved off the rebel onslaught, at least for the moment. With Libya divided, is it time for international intervention? What are the risks for the U.S. to lead the way? What are the risks of inaction? On Reporter's Notebook, a congressman who once supported the Irish Republican Army's violent attacks in Britain will chair hearings on the extent of radicalization of American Muslims. We'll hear about New York Republican Peter King. First, this news update. In the U.S. gasoline market, there is such a glut of supply that refiners are producing at just above 80% of capacity. So why are prices suddenly shooting up? Trilby Lundberg is president of the Lundberg Survey. She checks the pump prices all over the country every day. Good to have you on our program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
What's the answer to that question?
Well, the answer is, coming from what you just said about the glutted U.S. gasoline market, we have to separate gasoline from oil and the U.S. market from the world market. We do have much more gasoline than we need, and refineries are sitting on idled capacity. They'd love to bring back into commission. So gasoline prices can't go up on their own. It is crude oil that's doing it. And we can explain that in three parts. First of all, crude oil prices were rising dramatically long before the Libya problem because of the weaker dollar, causing investors to want to hold commodities instead, raising the price of crude and therefore gasoline at the pump. And then when Libya happened, we have the physical impact of that oil curtailment affecting crude oil grades that are similar that have to substitute and resonating around the world in all of the crudes, and then the final element being that famous fear factor that causes people to wonder if there's other oil exporting countries that are in turmoil that might actually curtail supply.
In that context, I understand that you have counted up the number of countries in the Middle East and North Africa that have violence or protests, and how many of them are oil producers. Tell us about that.
Well, there's a total of 15 of them. Several of them are oil countries. Egypt, arguably, because it consumes exactly the amount that it produces, so it's a net neutral, as we might say. But among the 15, there's Algeria, Libya, of course, and Saudi Arabia, not that violence to that degree, but concerns and protests, some turmoil, as well as Iraq, good old Iraq again, Bahrain, Iran, and Kuwait. We tend to forget about Iran because the regime is in such control of the protest, but the turmoil has gone on and on.
And, of course, oil is a fungible commodity, so what affects one affects the other. It isn't that Iran is withholding it because they don't want us to get it or something of that kind. The whole market has to be involved.
Yes, and some people are asking why crude oil, which is in plentiful supply, could go up. And one thing we have to remember is that our most common benchmark that we like to speak of here in the United States is West Texas Intermediate, a light, sweet grade not the lightest or sweetest, but it is of that high price caliber that's easy for lower tech refineries to use. But it's itself is glutted. So we need to really be looking at Brent crude, which is a much better benchmark for what is going on now, because its supply is tighter. And I understand that the price of Brent is up again today.
Does it make sense for the U.S. to look at the petroleum reserves at this point?
Well, I suppose it always makes sense when there is a possibility of a shortage. Even though the SPR has been used also for the psychological impact, as
strategic,
they say.
Strategic Petroleum Reserve is the SPR.
Yes, yes. The International Energy Agency, of which we are a member, didn't want to do that. Just a few days ago, the Paris organization said that emergency stocks should not be used when there is no severe shortage. It's possible that we will do that, and it's possible for a psychological effect. But until the world can see that Libya will come back into stability, and or that other oil producers will not catch this, if we could call it a contagion. And here's another problem. I also hear today that the Federal Reserve might do a QE3, that is, to buy more treasuries and, in other words, expand the glut of dollars, which raises the price of crude. If that happens, then that would be one of the elements in the mix of up price elements and down price elements that could mean price hikes at the pump.
Okay, very complicated situation, obviously, and the fear factor, as you indicated, we haven't had a chance to talk about it very much, but it's clear from what else you've said why there is such a thing. Trilby Lundberg, it's always good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Again, the president of the Lundberg Survey, which specializes in the U.S. petroleum market and checks prices at the pump around the country on a daily basis. In a moment, Gaddafi, the U.S., and the Muslim world on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. As the international media focus on Libya's possible civil war, Muammar Gaddafi appears to be secure in Tripoli. What has astonished one reporter is the perception of the residents of that capital city, which she describes as complete denial that their leader's government is under any real threat at all. Vivienne Walt arrived for the latest of many visits to Tripoli just this past weekend. She reports for Time magazine. Always good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Tell us, if you will, more about what you mean by complete denial.
Well, it's really amazing. There has been a kind of all-weekend victory party. Yes, victory. You might wonder why victory, but in fact, the Libyan people were told on the state television early on Saturday that, in fact, the fight was over and that they have won. And so thousands of people have poured into the streets to celebrate. There's been gunfire. There was gunfire all night long, the night before last night, celebratory gunfire, we're told. And people have been basically celebrating the end of this great threat, which even then they pin entirely on Al-Qaeda.
I've seen reports that some of those people that poured into the streets indicated that they were, in fact, dressed in civilian clothes, but really members of the militia or the army. Any truth to that, do you think?
Yes, I think there's certainly a truth to it. It's very hard to tell who is who in a lot of these countries, certainly in Libya. Firstly, every civilian has some kind of militia training after a certain age. And there are a lot of people who might be part of some or other security force who are now on the streets in plain clothes. In any case, there is rather a lot of security security services that are anyway plainclothed. So it's very difficult to tell who you're looking at when you see people celebrating Gaddafi, supporting him, coming out dressed in green with the green flags and posters of Gaddafi.
Tell us, if you will, about what the argument is with regard to al-Qaeda. What is State TV saying about that?
Well, for example, it's not just State TV, but top government officials have just this moment walked out of a briefing with the foreign minister of Libya, Moussa Koussa, who was saying that there is generally a plot to break up Libya, and that this is coming from two fronts, al-Qaeda and also the U.S. and Britain. He again blames the conflict in Libya completely on al-Qaeda and says that al-Qaeda's infiltrated the country and essentially brainwashed people into fighting against Muammar Gaddafi. And from the other side, they say that it's quite clear that the U.S. and Britain are in cahoots with these rebels, and that since there has been dialogue with the rebels, they too are in quite a sort of general conspiracy to undermine Libya and to break it into different pieces.
How are the rebels described? Who do they say they are?
They say that they are not Libyans. They say that they are both mercenaries and al-Qaeda. And we, in Tripoli, we get to speak to top government officials every night. Every night they've come to the hotel where all the foreign press is essentially forced to stay. And they brief us every night about what's happening. And every night we have heard the same story.
We seem to have lost the line there from Vivienne Walt in Tripoli. We don't know why that is the case, and we'll make an effort to get her back on our program. In the meantime, we have with us Martin Chulov, who's the Guardian's Middle East correspondent. He's reporting from Benghazi in Libya. Martin Chulov, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you, too.
You're at the other end of the country, which is, as we understand it, controlled by the rebels. We heard a moment ago about the accusation that the U.S. and Britain are in cahoots, as Vivienne Walt put it, with the rebels. What about the discovery of British troops who apparently had been helicoptered in, not very many of them, but who were helicoptered in and then captured by the rebels? Tell us about that story.
Well, that was an extraordinary development. On Thursday morning at 3 a.m., guards at a farm near a place called Jardina, which is 30 kilometers south of Benghazi, heard a helicopter come in. Just before that, one of the administrators at a factory called the El Kadra Farm Factory told the guards he was going out to Benghazi. He came back half an hour later with a car full of seven people. They unloaded a lot of kit. It was espionage equipment, recording devices, paramilitary uniforms. There were weapons. There were multiple passports. The guards all got suspicious. They walked over, fired a couple of shots into the air, and they said, "You guys are under arrest." The following morning, they called their boss. The boss called the head of the opposition or the head of the rebels in Benghazi, and they said, "Bring these guys in." It turns out that there were two MI6 officers, six SAS officers, which is the British Army's elite special forces unit. They were part of a unit that was airlifted in to link with the rebels, open up supply lines, and pave the way for foreign assistance to the rebels of East Libya.
So they indicated then what their mission was. What's happened to them? Do the rebels want them around?
Well, this is a strange thing. They'd been pleading for international help, especially when it came to establishing and enforcing a no-fly zone. Gaddafi's jets are something they cannot deal with. It is a game-changer having an air force that rules the skies, and they basically don't have the weapons to take them down. So they had been asking for international help, but these guys were caught with multiple passports. They didn't know who they were. They took them in. The Britons said, we're here to help. We're from the British government, but they weren't believed for a couple of days. There was no contact from Whitehall or Downing Street, and for 2 days or so, they were in limbo, and during those 2 days, word of their capture had leaked. by then the operation was blown, the cover was blown, and yesterday afternoon at sunset they were picked up by a British warship which docked in Benghazi very briefly, and now they're gone.
Martin Chuloff with The Guardian in Benghazi. Back to Vivian Walt. We have her back on the line from Tripoli. Has this incident been used by Gaddafi's forces to demonstrate that there really is a connection between the rebels and Britain in this case?
Absolutely. And in fact, since yesterday, since this story broke, we've heard repeatedly about the British and especially about the BBC as being extremely aligned with the rebels. But even tonight, the foreign minister, the main message he wanted to convey to the foreign journalists was that Britain and the U.S. were in cahoots with the rebels. And as he put it, that this is clear evidence that the superpowers are undertaking a plot against Libya. And this was really, I think, in some ways a great gift to the Gaddafi regime, really, was the capture of the SAS forces, because it proved what they were saying, which was that the West was against them, which is something they've always believed, and that essentially they were aligning themselves with the rebels in the East.
Back to Martin Chuloff in Benghazi. You have talked to the rebels, obviously, about this particular situation. They weren't all that happy to have the British people there, and as you indicated, they're now gone. What about the rebels themselves? Who are they, and where do they get the weapons to fight against the Gaddafi armed forces?
Well, they ended up with a huge arsenal, and how that happened was quite a stunning story in itself. The protests started in Benghazi on February 17. They were basically led by lawyers outside of the courthouse. And in the initial days, they were civil disobedience. They were lawyers pleading for more human rights, more access to justice for their clients, and various things like that. They were straight-up protests, people waving placards. On February 20, they were attacked with machine guns by government forces from up the road. Things got out of hand very, very quickly. Within hours, youths were storming military bases. The army was on the run. Within two days, Gaddafi's forces had been ousted from Benghazi. All military bases had been sacked. The government institutions had all been burned, looted, and pillaged. The city had fallen. And what was left behind as Gaddafi's forces fled to the west was a massive arsenal that was assembled. It's been put together. It's been distributed to the group of rebels, which was basically the standing army in eastern Libya, which has been joined by thousands of recruits who are turning up to training centres, and they've been given rudimentary training on anti-aircraft weapons and the like. But by and large, the rebel leadership and the rebel forces were the military who were loyal to Gaddafi until the city fell.
So what do they have to say about the no-fly zone? You indicated earlier that they had asked for it, but they rejected apparently the support of the Brits, who might have helped them get supplies, more supplies in, and so on. Are they confused about their goals?
I think that's a fair conclusion to draw. They didn't necessarily reject the British help. They were under the misapprehension that the Brits who were coming to meet them could have been mercenaries or could have been Israelis. They kept saying to me that when the Israeli Mossad, who was widely believed to have been responsible for the killing of the Hamas man in Dubai early last year, when they conducted that operation, a number of British passports were used. They say all we wanted to do was verify things with the Brits, and then we would have, you know, happily accepted their help. But by that point, the operation had been blown, and the Brits no longer wanted a part of it. But when it comes to a no-fly zone, they do want it. They do realize that they need to have an international sanction for that to happen. And without it, they cannot advance further than they are at the moment. They're about 350 kilometers to the west of Benghazi. There's a loose front line which has been established there. It moves 10, 20 miles every day, backwards and forwards. But beyond that is the city of Sirte. Now, that's where Gaddafi was born, and it is a stronghold of his forces. They cannot get to Sirte. As soon as they start to advance, they're getting hit by jets. And they know that that's the way things are going to proceed forevermore, unless they come up with a game changer, and that is keeping the jets on the ground.
Martin Chuloff again, the Guardian reporter, now in Benghazi in Libya. Shadi Hamid is a director of research at Brookings Doha Center. He's also a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Shadi Hamid, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think that there is a case to be made for intervention by the international community and in particular the United States?
Yeah, I think we're at that point now. We were actually probably at that point quite some time ago. As Martin pointed out, the rebels can't win this on their own, or at least it doesn't seem likely that they can right now. They don't have enough firepower. They don't have the air support. And that's why we're at a stalemate now, and there's a real risk that this could really break out into a protracted civil war that could last months. And let's also be clear, this is a situation where thousands of civilians have been killed, and actually slaughter is the more appropriate word. And that was, in theory, why we have an international community, or why we have the UN, to intervene when crimes against humanity are committed. It's actually right there in the UN Charter, Chapter 7. With all that in mind, it's a little bit distressing that people were bringing up the no-fly zone almost 2 weeks ago, and we're still discussing it and going back and forth, and there hasn't really been much progress in that direction. And for those who bring up the issue of tainting the rebels with Western imperialism, that's nonsense, because the rebels themselves have been calling consistently for a no-fly zone, for international intervention. They don't care if it's U.S. or European. They want someone to help them. But they obviously draw the line at ground troops, and that seems to be where the consensus is. Yes to no-fly zone, no to ground troops.
Martin Chuloff, back to you in Benghazi. You've been around the area a bit. Do you see signs of a slaughter?
In the early days, certainly from, say, February 17 through to February 21, there was widespread bloodshed in Benghazi, no doubt about that. The hospitals, the morgues were full. There were signs of battle. There were signs of slaughter everywhere. But put that into perspective, though, the military bases were attacked. This wasn't a peaceful stroll through the city of Benghazi. This was the start of a blood and guts revolution. When we hit the front lines now, yes, there are killings, there is violence, there is shooting on both sides, but we haven't seen Benghazi strafed by jets as had happened earlier in Tripoli. In the past 2 weeks that I've been here, we haven't seen the city attacked. We've seen Ajdabiya to the south, we've seen Brega and Ras Al-Nufal bombed, but Benghazi has not been attacked by Benghazi's forces for the past fortnight.
Okay, Martin Chuloff again in Benghazi. Shadi Hamid at the Doha Center for the Brookings Institution. We'll continue our conversation with you and others. Vivian Walt with Time Magazine in Tripoli, thanks very much to you for being on our program today. We're going to take a very brief break on Reporter's Notebook, Peter King's hearings on Muslim Americans and terrorism, a defense requirement or hypocrisy. You can join our conversation on our To the Point Facebook page. We'll be back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, talking today about Libya and Muammar Gaddafi. We just heard from Martin Chuloff, the Guardian's correspondent in Benghazi, that at the outset there was, in fact, widespread bloodshed. But he also pointed out that military bases were subject to armed attack. It was the start of a revolution. Let me go back to Shadi Hamid at the Brookings Doha Center. If that's the case, doesn't any government have a right to defend itself?
Well, protesters have a right to defend themselves when they're being shot and killed by their own government. And these were peaceful protesters in the early days. They had no choice. So I don't think we can draw any moral equivalency here. It's actually a good thing that the slaughter has stopped in Benghazi and other parts of the East. I mean, that's what we want. We want there to be less slaughter. I mean, the real risk is that Gaddafi still has his air force, and he still has the option to bomb cities and kill a large number of civilians. And the point of international intervention is not to wait until thousands more are killed, but to prevent them from being killed in the first place.
Back to Martin Chulov. I don't know if moral equivalence is what you're talking about here, but it does sound to me as if there was more than just peaceful protest going on, and that, as I indicated, it might be that the government would have, any government would have a right to respond with arms.
Initially, the demonstrations were peaceful. There wasn't any doubt about that. They were protesting with placards. They were protesting against the regime, and they were attacked. And they were mowed down with heavy machine guns. We've seen the battle scars ourselves on the buildings. We've seen the wounds in the hospitals.
And these were civilians that were attacked.
They absolutely were civilians initially. There's no doubt about that. Things did get developed very quickly. And as you say, the bases were subject to armed attack. Now, do we draw a moral equivalence there? I don't know. I mean, that's one for the broad sweep of history. But I do agree with the point that what remains is a Gaddafi who is vengeful, who does want to get back into Eastern Libya, who has been ousted in a dramatic way, and dignity demands that he tries to do something about that. He tries to avenge it. He does have an air force. He does have a means to attack civilian populations. He does have a track record of doing so. And all in Benghazi suspect that will indeed happen when international eyes avert.
So back to Shadi Hamid then. Your point is we, the world, haven't acted fast enough, and we're losing time.
Exactly. That the right time for action probably would have been earlier, but the real danger now is that we're seeing the outbreak of a real civil war that's going to last a long time. And now the question that we in the West have to ask ourselves, is that something that we're comfortable with? Are we willing to watch this continue indefinitely? And as Martin pointed out, there's always the risk of reprisals against the East. The people of Benghazi are waiting for it and worried about it. And it's almost certainly the case that if Gaddafi recaptures parts of the East, there is going to be blood in the streets. There's no doubt about that. So I think we have a moral choice ahead of us, but it's not just about morals. It's about interest, too. And this is not good for the regional stability of the Middle East. It's not good for Libya's neighbors. And it's not good for the West's reputation and credibility. People are looking to the West for moral leadership. The Libyan rebels themselves are looking for moral leadership from the West, and so far they're not seeing it. Britain and France have started talking about a no-fly zone and presenting that to the UN Security Council, but the U.S. has been behind the curve, and that's a real point of concern. And I think what people were hoping for from Obama was more bold leadership on this.
Again, Shadi Hami is with the Brookings Doha Center. Aaron David Miller is a public policy fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, author of the book The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Surge for Arab-Israeli Peace. Talking about a different kind of peace right now. Aaron David Miller, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Pleasure, Warren.
What kind of problems does this pose for the United States when we have people such as Shadi Hamid say, we need moral leadership here, when the U.S. has been so roundly attacked and so resented for what it's doing in Iraq and Afghanistan?
I think there are so many contradictions and anomalies for us. And to date, the Arab Spring, so to speak, has not been an American story. Libya, in a sense, makes it an American story, in large part because the Obama administration really faces a conundrum. You have our ambassador at the UN talking, using the word slaughter, which conveys a sense of real urgency and moral compulsion to act. You've got the president and the secretary of state articulating at least once that Gaddafi has lost the legitimacy of his people and must go or must step down. And you have the CENTCOM moving naval assets to the Mediterranean. So there's no question, anomaly number one is that the gap between our rhetorical positions and our actions so far has been very large. I think, with all due respect to your previous guest, the question for the United States is really only one, and it has to be asked with a degree of clarity that usually does not characterize our policy, and that is this. What is our objective? If our objective is the removal of Colonel Gaddafi, then there's no question that that can be done, whether we do it unilaterally or whether it can be done in a multilateral context. The issue, though, is what are the risks and the returns, what are the risks and the returns of the projection, yet again, of American military power into a very difficult situation in another Muslim country. And I think, again, with all due respect to your guest, the reality is when great powers act, they need to act with clarity. They need to act with a firm understanding of what the consequences will be. We have seen all too painfully clear, even though I'm not comparing Afghanistan and Iraq, what the costs and the risks are of the projection of American military power into situations where they really, frankly, don't have a clue about what is actually taking place. And while Libya is not Afghanistan or Iraq, we know very little about Colonel Gaddafi's capacity and less, frankly, about the opposition. So I do not criticize the president, and I would urge people to be very disciplined and restrained before they push the United States into yet another military action. Because, frankly, Warren, that's what it's going to take to get rid of Gaddafi.
If there were established, as Shadi Hamid said, a no-fly zone, which at least some of the rebels have asked for, but no foreign ground troops, would that make a difference?
Well, let's be clear. The nature of this conflict, and I don't want to get into the moral symmetry or asymmetry argument either, but the nature of this conflict since February 17th has changed. It's no longer an Arab spring a la Tunisia and Egypt. It's more frankly an Arab winter in which you now have a serious civil conflict, despite the asymmetry of power, between two armed parties. A no-fly zone, and let's be clear, is not a humanitarian issue. It places the United States or whoever is going to enforce it as an active combatant into such a situation. And yes, I think it could absolutely begin to reshape the military balance, but we would have to take certain committing steps and expend resources in order to do it. At the end of the day, what is the reason for a putative international or American military response? It seems to me the urgency is conveyed by only one thing, and that is this an example of systematic wholesale killings in which thousands of Libyans will die, defenseless, innocent Libyans, and the international community has a responsibility to protect? Otherwise, we have to be very careful about getting involved in a situation about which we know very little, including, I might add, arming the opposition. These weapons have a way of appearing in other places, being used against American forces in other places, or sold on the black market. So I know it's hard to watch this, but the president rightly is subjecting this situation to cruel and unforgiving analysis, which is exactly what he should do, and it is in the American interest.
Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. George Joffe is a lecturer in the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge. He specializes in the Middle East and North Africa. He's the former director of studies at the Royal Institute for International Affairs at Chatham House in London. George Joffe, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
What's your take on the viability of intervention of whether it would succeed?
Well, let me first of all say that I endorse wholeheartedly what Aaron David Miller has just said. And then let me add to that something else. And that is that one needs to bear in mind that in the Arab world generally, Western policy, that's to say American and European policy, is very much disliked. And it's disliked because people in the Arab world feel that over the last six decades, Western states have supported governments that they regard as repressive, and that's gone on year after year after year. Now, that means that if the West now intervenes, this will be seen as an aggressive act. It won't be seen as necessarily a question of helping Libyans. And that means that any direct intervention of the kind that apparently has been suggested would be extremely unwise. particularly if it doesn't have United Nations sanction. And at the moment, there is no United Nations sanction for such action. In those circumstances, I think President Obama has been quite right to be extremely cautious. And over the question of the no-fly zone, which is seen at the moment as a means by which this can be done without engaging too much in terms of assets, one needs to remember that to achieve a no-fly zone, as Bill Gates said some days ago, it will be necessary to take out the whole of the Libyan anti-aircraft system, particularly around the Gulf of Sirte region, where it protects the oil fields. Now, that would be a major intervention, and that would imply that the United States and Europe would have to continue engaging to guarantee that it would be able to neutralize the forces of Colonel Gaddafi. That's a major commitment, and I don't think either in Washington or indeed in Brussels or other European capitals there would be any desire to do that. It's much too dangerous.
What about the moral issue that Shadi Hamid raises if, in fact, Colonel Gaddafi intends, as he has the capacity to do, to slaughter, to use the word of the United States ambassador to the United Nations, many, many innocent people?
Well, we have a mechanism by which we can deal with that, and it's already been mentioned by Aaron David Miller. It is the responsibility to protect mechanism decided in 2004 in the United Nations. If that were to be invoked, then the Security Council will be in a position to empower states to act. But to act without that, I think, would be extremely dangerous. Beyond that, too, it's not quite clear to me quite how we think we're going to actually be able to interdict Colonel Gaddafi from carrying out the massacres that he's threatened. Libya is an enormous country. The number of forces that will be required to guarantee security there would be colossal. Certain European states don't have those resources, and the United States, I wouldn't have thought, given its other commitments, would be in a position to do that either, nor indeed would it want to do so. So I think before we undertake that sort of action, we need to be very clear about what the commitment is going to be.
George Jaffe again at the University of Cambridge. Back to Shadi Hamid with the Brookings Institution. How do you respond to what we've heard from both of our last two guests?
Professor Jaffe is exactly right. The U.S. is disliked because we've supported dictators for the last five decades, and we have undermined democratic movements. So Libya actually presents the opposite of what Professor Jaffe suggests. This is our chance to be on the right side of an issue that we've gotten wrong for decades. So yes, people dislike us, but we have a chance now to show that we have a real commitment to democracy, the protection of civilian life. And again, on this issue of Western imperialism and the taint and all of that, let us again be very clear. Libyans themselves have called on us to intervene. This is not an imposition from the West. As for the responsibility to protect, we've already met that trigger. There have already been crimes against humanity committed. There has been a mass slaughter. Thousands have been killed. Now, people might argue that the trigger should be 10,000 or 20,000 lives lost before we decide it's time to intervene. But that's precisely what responsibility to protect is supposed to prevent. We are supposed to prevent the mass killing of life. And again, we have that opportunity to do that through taking more, more aggressive action here. And I'll just say again, we're not talking about ground troops or a ground invasion. We're talking about a no-fly zone. Yes, a no-fly zone is risky. It's challenging, but bold action is always risky. I mean, that's sort of the point.
Well, we just heard from George. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we just heard from George Jaffe that you would not need just a no-fly zone, difficult as that would be to impose in and of itself, but also a number of forces in order to really enforce security in Libya. What about the cost of that?
Well, that is true, but what I'm saying is that ground troops are not being called for. Ground troops are not necessary. I'm not calling for a ground invasion of Libya. So, yes, we have to have limits on what our scope of action is in Libya. No one denies that. No one pretends otherwise. A no-fly zone is challenging. There may be problems. There may be escalation. But we have to choose between a variety of different alternatives. None of them are ideal. But I think standing silent and not acting is the worst of all possible options, because it puts us in a very difficult position morally, but let's also just, but also legally. I mean, there is a legal obligation according to Chapter 7 of the UN Charter to act when crimes against humanity are being committed. Now, people can argue that that standard hasn't been met, but I think the evidence suggests otherwise.
George Joffe, what do you say to all that?
Well, first of all, I'm not certain that the standard of crimes against humanity has actually been met. Secondly, even if you were to pass or institute a no-fly zone, you'd still be left with the problem that most of the action is taking place on the ground. Now, how actually do you interdict that? Because there's no evidence that a no-fly zone would also mean that you eliminate the assets, the ground assets that Colonel Gaddafi would have. So you couldn't impede the massacres he might want to carry out. All you would do would be to stop him using aircraft to help in that process. Now, that doesn't seem to me to really meet the target that your other guest has suggested. And then beyond that, any action that doesn't have United Nations sanction is going to be viewed very badly by the Arab world, even if we claim it's on the side of democracy. They may well feel that it's on the side of oil, because they would argue that our main concern is to guarantee our access to Libyan oil and thereby to secure a supreme strategic asset. Seems to me the option of military engagement is full of so many dangers that it shouldn't be undertaken without very careful thought. And I'm not yet convinced that that thought process has actually taken place.
Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, would you hope and assume that President Obama would try to get responsibility to protect a vote from the UN Security Council and therefore be empowered to act? Is that, do you think, what the administration is envisioning?
I don't think so. I don't know, but I don't think so. I mean, first of all, you face the almost certain probability on the part of the Russians and the Chinese, who have their own respective, how shall I put this, domestic problems in Chechnya and Tibet. The last thing they are going to want to do is to use this as a precedent to open up their own backyards in the event down the road that they're faced with a similar problem. Second, we the United States have a major problem, because your other guest was right. We have cut the devil's bargain for over 40 years with regimes for whom we've given a pass on governments and human rights in exchange for their capacity to support our policies on war and peacemaking. The problem is that we are still in the devil's bargain, that in states like Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, where America has real interests, we are dealing with regimes who, frankly, don't have much regard for the human rights or political equality or democratic systems of the reformists. So we also, it's one thing to take action against Gaddafi. It's another to begin to assert that somehow when we're faced with opposition, which turns violent and bloody, that somehow we are going to then impose a kind of interventionist cast to our own policy. So this is another contradiction, another anomaly, which makes it very hard for the United States to choose. At the end of the day, as an American, as hard as this is to watch, given the problems we have at home, I am not prepared to support a policy that has us own yet another Muslim country. And the fact is, responsibility to protect, insertion of ground forces means getting in the middle. It's harder to get out than it is to get in, and we will be faced sooner or later with a much more committing role in Libya than we ever thought we would play. We have to be tough, I know it's hard, and very discriminating about what we choose to do.
Very quickly, George Joffe, we're almost out of time, but you're a student of Libya and of Muammar Gaddafi. What do you think he's likely to do, and will we, do you think, as Aaron David Miller suggests, perhaps be in a position of simply watching him resume his defeat the rebels and continue in power in Libya?
Well, I think it's not quite as easy as that. Colonel Gaddafi has lost enormous prestige inside Libya by the simple fact that the East has broken away. And that means that he's been diminished in stature inside Tripolitania too. We already know that there's been attempts to move the rebellion into Tripolitania, and that's very threatening for him. I think that over time, as he attempts to regain control. His support inside Tripoli will begin to weaken. The tribes that support him will begin to break away. The militias will become tired and threatened, and he will eventually face an internal coup, and that will bring his regime to an end. It's going to take time. It's going to be bloody. But I think that's the way in which it's going to be resolved.
We'll have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you all. George Jaffe, again, at the Department of International Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge, formerly with Chatham House. Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Shahid Hamid at the Brookings Doha Center. Martin Chuloff, our earlier guest from Benghazi in Libya with the Guardian newspaper. And Vivian Walt with Time magazine reporting from Tripoli. Good to have all of you with us. Thanks very much. On Thursday, New York Republican Peter King, chair of the Homeland Security Committee, will begin hearings on what he calls the extent of the radicalization of American Muslims. As a former defender of the Irish Republican Army, King knows a lot about radicalization. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Many American Muslims are angry about Peter King's upcoming hearings, and the Obama White House tried to reassure them over the weekend. Although King was a supporter of the Irish Republican Army and their violent attacks, both Bill Clinton and Tony Blair credit him with helping to bring peace ultimately. But critics still accuse him of imposing a double standard. Amnesty International says it's hypocrisy. That's according to a report by Peter Finn of The Washington Post. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be with you.
Tell us about the extent of Peter King's support for the Irish Republican Army at a time when it was blowing up people in London and elsewhere.
Well, he first went to Northern Ireland in 1980 on a fact-finding mission with Al D'Amato, who had just been elected Republican senator in New York. And from then on, he immersed himself in the subject. I think over the following 10 years, he probably went to Northern Ireland 20 times or more, which is more than once, twice a year. So unlike some Irish Americans who, you know, were sympathetic but at a great distance, King was in Belfast on a regular basis. He stayed in the homes of IRA activists. He was in the Falls Road, a frequent visitor to the Felons Club, which was an IRA club. He knew all the major players, Gerry Adams. In fact, when he was elected to Congress in 1992, his first act, so to speak, as congressman-elect, was to fly to Belfast and sit down to talk to Gerry Adams and invite him to his swearing-in in Congress.
Should point out that one of the other supporters of the IRA was Muammar Gaddafi, the man we've been talking about in Libya. And yet, Peter King is unapologetic about his support for the IRA.
He is. I mean, he said back then in much stronger terms than he does now, but he continues to believe that the IRA was a legitimate force, that they represented the opinions of a large segment of the Catholic population in Northern Ireland, and that their violence was the result of internal repression. And that makes it quite different from Islamic terrorism, which he sees as a global war, as globally directed.
What about this charge of hypocrisy from Amnesty International? How do they support it?
Well, they allege that terrorism is terrorism, and that if you support terrorism in one context because you happen to believe in the cause that people are fighting for, then it's very difficult for you to condemn terrorism in another context. Peter King, of course, does not accept that argument, and it gets back to the, you know, old problem, you know, who's a terrorist, who's a freedom fighter.
So he sees then the IRA, obviously, as the freedom fighters. Does he acknowledge that they were engaged in terrorism when they were blowing up innocent people in Northern Ireland and Manchester and in London?
Yes. I mean, he says he, you know, did not condone the loss of civilian life. I mean, the problem with the IRA is there were 600 civilians who were killed over the course of their 30-year campaign. But he argues and did argue that they did not deliberately target civilians.
He said at the time, as I believe, that Britain was a sort of killing machine. So I take it he was supportive of attacks against the British troops?
Yeah. Well,
and still is.
Well, I mean, it's over now. There are no
sure.
attacks in Northern Ireland. But at that time, yes. I mean, he supported their campaign as a legitimate campaign.
Interesting, then, that he ultimately was given credit for helping to bring peace by the President of the United States and the former Prime Minister of Britain.
Yes, but, you know, the IRA, Sinn Féin, are now, you know, part of the democratic process north and south. I mean, Gerry Adams was just elected to the Parliament of the Republic of Ireland. He topped the poll in the constituency where he stood. So there have been, you know, major changes in Ireland, and, you know, Peter King was part of the peace process. Both Clinton and Blair say he played a significant role because he was, frankly, the only person in Washington when this process began who knew Adams and could communicate with him.
All right, some fascinating background on the hearings that will begin into Muslim Americans on Thursday. Peter Finn, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Reporter for The Washington Post. Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Christian Bordahl and Francis Anderton. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.